Hi again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Friday, the 9th of February. It was the first concentrated involvement of African-American artists, writers, musicians, singers, and intellectuals in an artistic and cultural movement that addressed the realities of the color line in all its complexity. That's what our guest says. Actually, says a lot more about the Harlem Renaissance. We're speaking this hour with the editor of Harlem Speaks, A Living History of the Harlem Renaissance. It is that time in America, in Harlem, when African Americans, the U.S. and the world, were being buffeted by forces of change that not many people understood. Race, its connection to the past, the future of the nation, was quite fundamental, and it was addressed by many artists, by jazz artists, by poets, by people writing novels, by magazine editors, and so much talent coming from this part of America. And the book is terrific because it has a CD on it, and we're going to play some of the pieces, so you'll get to hear Langston Hughes, such an important part of the Harlem Renaissance and such a prolific poet and writer for so many years. We'll hear Langston Hughes with one of his more important poems. Zora Neale Hurston, we'll hear a little bit of her, Bessie Smith, Louis Armstrong. And our guest is the editor of Harlem Speaks. Our guest is Professor Kerry Wintz, who's a professor of history at Texas Southern University in Houston, also the author of Black Culture and the Harlem Renaissance, The Harlem Renaissance, 1920 to 1940, Interpretation of an African-American Literary Movement, and The Harlem Renaissance, A History and an Anthology. As always, we welcome your phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, 227-2050. Professor Wintz, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me this morning.
You say early in the book that it's necessary to recognize the Harlem Renaissance in terms of time and in place. Why don't you talk about that?
Well, I'm a historian, I guess, and that's where all historians start, time and place, when something happens and where it happens. For the Harlem Renaissance, the timing, I think, is very, very important. On the larger scale, this is roughly 50 years after emancipation. You've had two generations, and this would be the third generation emerging. So you have a literate African-American community. You have some people who, in spite of all the difficulties, have become middle class and upper middle class. You have people who are well-educated. You have a base from which to develop a cultural and literary movement. That's one thing, and an audience for that. The place is something else. This also occurs at in the early stages of the great migration of African Americans out of the rural South to the nation cities, and for the first time, large numbers in northern and Great Lakes cities. So that's the second factor taking place, and along with that come the institutions.
You talk about this day, I don't know if I typed this right or not, it was in March in 1924, was it, at a civic club in Manhattan. A gathering occurred that would dramatically alter African-American literature and its relationship to American culture. It's nice to look at a day, and you write about what happened there and how huge an influence it was.
It really was. The event was initially conceived as a small dinner to celebrate the publication of a novel by a woman named Jessie Fawcett, who was also the literary editor and a close associate of the literary editor of the Crisis magazine and a close associate of W.E.B. Du Bois, first of five novels that she wrote. The event simply grew because there were, as people know, there were so many other young writers who were getting ready to publish or had published poetry in magazines. And so this ended up with over 100 people. It brought together the black intellectuals and critics like Du Bois, James Weldon Johnson and others. Elaine Locke of Howard University came to New York for the event. It brought together the young writers, including Jessie Fawcett and others. And it brought together the critics and the publishers from the white publishing world. And more than anything else, it sort of was a coming out party for the literary phase of the Harlem Renaissance.
And some of the people were signed on the spot, right?
That's right. Elaine Locke on the spot signed to produce a Harlem issue of Survey Graphic magazine, a magazine that generally dealt with social issues, but this one would deal with art and culture. Mm. That became an anthology a year later called The New Negro, which did a great deal to define sort of the parameters of the literary movement and also talked about the art, visual art, and the music.
Mm-hmm. Do you primarily think of this as first and foremost a literary movement?
I did before this book. I came out of literature and politics, and most of my earlier work talks about the Harlem Renaissance in terms of literature and politics. In this one, we really went out of our way to expand this and really integrate the music and the visual arts and the theater.
Mm-hmm.
Musical theater primarily. It's a big book, but we didn't have nearly, it could have been twice as big.
I'll bet it could have.
Very easily.
The other event that you talk about was jazz being brought to Broadway.
African-American musical theater brought to Broadway, and this occurred 3 years earlier. This is why with historians, dates are so complex. What is the beginning date? Well, if you're talking about literature, it's 1924. Talking about musical theater, it's 1921. U.B. Blake and Cecil Noble put together a musical theater review. It had a loose plot line, but it featured dancing and songs. It was called Shuffle Along. It was the first time that African Americans took a black written, black financed, black produced, black performed production into the a major Broadway theater during the Broadway season.
And it went on for a long time. It was enormously successful, wasn't it?
It was enormously successful. Not only did it go on for a long time, but it spawned a whole series of similar plays. So that from 1921 into the early 1930s, there was something like this happening on Broadway all the time.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the white interaction. When you think of the Harlem Renaissance, you think of, for lack of a better word, maybe this is an appropriate word, a lot of white tourists who are coming into Harlem to the Cotton Club to hear jazz, to be a part of this Renaissance. What was white involvement in this Renaissance, and what about black African Americans living in Harlem, their response to the white tourists?
Well, you have white involvement on a number of levels. The one that you mentioned is certainly a very interesting one, and this was the fact that Harlem becomes a tourist center, not just for New Yorkers who sort of go up north to for the exotic nightlife of Harlem, but for people from Europe, from people from all over the United States. It became, if you come to New York City, well, what are you going to do in the evening? You got to go to Harlem, and you go to the Cotton Club, or if you're really courageous, some of the other clubs. The Cotton Club was always safe because it was segregated. It was black for performers for white audiences. If you were a black patron, you did not get in except in very rare exceptions. The other clubs, there were one or two others like the Harlem, like the Cotton Club, that were segregated. The other clubs were black clubs, and you had fewer whites in them. Some were mixed. Some were almost exclusively black. And they ranged from basement dives where dancing and jazz musicians played to very elaborate shows like those at the Cotton Club. Where, for a time, Duke Ellington held forth every night. He was the house orchestra, and the show was broadcast live on radio across the whole country.
Oh, my. Let's talk about, I want to play some Langston Hughes here in a moment. You write about Langston Hughes going to house rent parties, a place where working-class blacks could drink and dance without a white tourist looking over their shoulder. Let's talk a little bit about Langston Hughes. The book is wonderful because you have all, I don't know where you found a lot of these recordings, but they're just priceless, and they really give us a sense of all the richness that came from the Harlem Renaissance. He was a big part, a very interesting background he had, and was such a prolific writer for a long period of time.
Yes, Langston Hughes endured, physically endured, longer than any of the other writers. He began, published his first work in the very early 1920s, and was writing up to the time of his death in 1967.
Mm-hmm.
So it was and lived on his writings. He really did not have another job.
Hmm.
He would get grants and fellowships sometimes. He would have speaking tours. He had at one time or another patrons who either provided him income or gave him a place to live free and write, which is very valuable to a writer. But he was in many ways the most well-known writer, and certainly was the most well-known writer until the emergence of Zora Neale Hurston and her great acclaim that has followed. He was born in Joplin, Missouri. He grew up in Kansas. His mother and father separated. His father went to Mexico, where he became a very successful mining engineer in outside of Mexico City. Langston's mother was gone much of the time, so he lived with a grandmother and with neighbors when his grandmother passed away.
Hmm.
And grew up essentially attending white schools. It's kind of ironic that this that Kansas, Topeka, Kansas, becomes the symbol of desegregation.
Right.
Well, his mother got him in white schools, and he grew up in this situation, and he was obviously a very lonely child, and began to write when he was in high school. And went to high school in Cleveland. His mother had married, remarried, and was in Cleveland, and that's where he did his first writing. He went to Harlem briefly, and then out and back to Washington, and then traveled to Africa working on a ship. He really sort of came to this not from a middle-class background, maybe a middle-class background intellectually, but economically,
mm-hmm.
he came out of poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And became a sensation. And what he did in terms of his poetry was to write poems for the ordinary people.
Mm-hmm.
He used, and he consciously used the styles and rhythms and wordings of the blues, particularly, and also jazz.
Mm-hmm.
To write about ordinary people.
Mm-hmm. So this, one of his most popular poems, it's included in the CD in the book. Do you want to give us background, Mother to Son?
Mother to Son. And a very interesting poem, because, as I said, his mother was absent during, or in and out of his life during, actually his whole life, but he remained very close to her, and she was always sort of a place of refuge. She's not the sort of person, though, that he turned to for advice. So it's kind of interesting that he almost creates this fictional mother. But it's a story about struggle, and it's a story that puts dignity into the struggle. And I think that's the key to this poem.
Langston Hughes reading Mother to Son.
Well, son, I'll tell you. Life for me ain't been no crystal stair. It's had tacks in it and splinters and boards torn up and places with no carpet on the floor, bare. But all the time, I's been a-climbing on and reaching landings and turning corners and sometimes going in the dark where there ain't been no light. So, boy, don't you turn back. Don't you sit down on the steps 'cause you finds it kind of hard. Don't you fall now, for I's still going, honey. I's still climbing, and life for me ain't been no crystal stair.
Langston Hughes reading his poem Mother to Son, published when he was only 20 years old. He was so young.
Amazing, isn't it?
Yes.
There are a number of poems that he wrote when he was still in high school.
Hmm.
One of his most famous and a very sophisticated poem, in that it integrates the African American experience into the history of the world, is the poem I've known the Negro speaks of rivers. Starting off, I've known rivers and links African Americans to the Nile, to the Euphrates, to the Mississippi. An amazing story for an adolescent.
Yeah. We're going to welcome phone calls. We're talking with the editor of Harlem Speaks, A Living History of the Harlem Renaissance. And also included in this is a CD filled with poetry and music from the Harlem Renaissance, which is quite a treat. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee line is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050 for you to join our conversation. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is Professor Kerry Wintz. He is the editor of Harlem Speaks, A Living History of the Harlem Renaissance. And we're welcoming phone calls at 800-486-8655. Let's weave into the conversation before we go to some phone calls. W.E.B. Du Bois, you were mentioning earlier, you talk about as being the most significant African-American intellectual of the first half of the 20th century. His magazine published, I believe, Langston Hughes. And yet a lot of young writers thought he was a bit too stodgy. So he became more of a critic than a promoter of the Harlem Renaissance. That's quite a story.
It is. It is an interesting story. And I think that you have to remember one thing. He was born in 1868. So he was already in his 50s at the end of World War One, and of course, he lives into his 90s, so he has a very long life.
Mm-hmm.
He was primarily concerned. He was the editor of The Crisis. He was an officer of the NAACP, one of the founders of the NAACP. And his concern was race, was addressing the discrimination that African Americans face. And what he believed in art, but as he said, he believes that art should be propaganda. That art should be used to create positive images of African Americans. And he had a very classical education at Harvard and the University of Berlin. And so for him, jazz and the blues, that's lower class music. That's not going to elevate the image of African Americans. He would support classical composers. And there were African American classical composers. In terms of literature, he liked some of the literature. In fact, he wrote a novel himself. He wrote two novels in his career, and one during the Harlem Renaissance, meant to be a model of what the type of writing should be. He wanted novels about educated, intellectual, middle-class, upper-middle-class blacks. Again, to present an image of blacks being just like whites.
Right.
Langston Hughes and others tended not to go along with that.
Mm-hmm.
Langston Hughes put it very bluntly in an essay that he wrote in 1926 entitled The Negro Artist and the Racial Mountain. It was published in The Nation, a very prominent mainstream magazine of ideas in the 1920s. And to paraphrase, he basically said that we writers will write life as we see it. If the blacks don't like it, that's too bad. If the whites don't like it, that's too bad. We'll be, in a sense, free with our own vision and present it, you know, as we wish.
Yeah.
And you can argue about that. This was a difficult time politically and racially in the United States. And it wasn't that Du Bois didn't believe in the arts. He did, but his priorities were the racial problem.
Right. Let's go to some phone calls. Gerard from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi.
Wonderful show that you got going here today. Just love the topic. I was just finishing up a couple books I've reread, one by Langston Hughes. It was an autobiography he had written called I Wonder As I Wander. And then, of course, there was a compilation of his works. I forget the title. It was done by another author of some of his writings during that period. So I would suggest that if anybody wants to find out more about the Harlem Renaissance, that they would turn to, especially his autobiography.
Yeah. Yes, that's an excellent work. And what that book does, that picks up his life in the early 1930s, really when he sort of leaves Harlem. And what it shows, that this is somebody who traveled the world and met with all of the great people of his era. I mean, this is a person who was not confined to simply African-American readers or even American readers. This is someone who is an international literary and intellectual figure. Let me suggest, read the first volume of his autobiography also. It's called The Big C. And that's when he talks about Harlem and being in Harlem during the Harlem Renaissance. But you've picked out two very, very good books. I assume your anthology is the one that Arnold Rappersad did. Is that correct?
That's correct, sir.
And Arnold is the person who wrote the essay on Langston Hughes for this collection.
Oh, great.
And I just had one other question, too. I was wondering about another writer who, to me, Richard Wright.
Yes.
Of course, who was a friend of Langston Hughes. And he doesn't seem to get as much of notice as a Renaissance writer, even though I know he came from Chicago. He didn't, and he moved to New York later on, I believe it was in the late 20s or so. But does he have a place amongst the pantheon of writers, in your opinion?
He's
well,
got
I'll,
a place
I'll tell
in
you
book.
One thing. He has a chapter in my book.
Right.
So I put him in. That, well, one of the reasons that he's not often put in with the Harlem Renaissance is because, as you noted, he came along later. It wasn't that he came from Chicago. Almost everybody in the Harlem Renaissance came from someplace else and moved to New York, as did Richard Wright.
Mm-hmm.
But Wright really publishes his first great book in the very late 1930s. He comes to Harlem in 1938, and this is in the last years of the Harlem Renaissance. Secondly, Wright publishes a very powerful essay in which he, in a sense, very clearly separates himself from the Harlem Renaissance. He's very critical of the Harlem Renaissance. The essay we have here argues that despite his protest, he's very much of that tradition, that he grew up on the literature of the Harlem Renaissance and was writing doing the type of writing that fit very well in with that. And that's why we included him in the book.
You also talk about, and don't go away, Gerard, you probably have more to say here. You also talk about Native Son, that he published Native Son, which was a huge financial success for him. And I'm wondering, did a lot of the Harlem Renaissance writers, particularly the literary figures, enjoy the same kind of financial success that Richard Wright did? And what financial success did to him just in terms of how he proceeded with his life?
Well, you're absolutely right. Nobody up to this point came anywhere close to the financial success that Richard Wright received. Langston Hughes finally made a little bit of money, enough to buy his house in Harlem in the mid-1930s, you know, after writing steadily for a decade and a half. He had a hit play, and that was that enabled him to buy his house. But even after that, he had to live a relatively modest lifestyle. Richard Wright, what this did for Richard Wright was to give him independence. It basically financed him for the rest of his life. Some of his other works, that was the book that made the most money.
Mm-hmm.
And he was able to, he moved to Paris in the 1940s and then back. And then after World War II, he relocated to Paris and was able to live comfortably on the money that he had made there. There's some talk also whether his great success created any jealousy, and I'm sure it did to a degree. It,
mm-hmm.
was frustrating.
Money can do that, right?
Money can do
yeah.
that. And before Richard Wright, the people who made the money, the ones that made the money were the musicians. Duke Ellington,
mm-hmm.
and Louis Armstrong and some of the singers, Ethel Waters, although some of them made money and spent money, but others did fairly well, I mean, very well financially.
Yeah.
Duke Ellington was one of the highest paid people for a long time.
My. Gerard, go ahead.
Yeah, Professor, I just want to say, too, that I know that Langston Hughes has been described as a kind of a jazz poet.
Yes.
I guess maybe because of how he structured his poems to fit into this kind of a jazz swing kind of mode. Could you maybe speak to more of that? And I'll just take my comments.
All right, Gerard.
And I just love this program, Kathleen.
Great. Yeah, thanks for listening and calling.
Thank you very much for calling. And your questions are very, very well informed. You know a lot about this already. Very good questions. Langston Hughes, as I mentioned earlier, took the music out of Harlem, and this music was jazz and the blues, and modeled his poetry on it. The blues is a very structured rhythm. In fact, one of the recordings, he talks about this, how he applies the structure of the blues to a poem and then reads a poem entitled The Weary Blues, in which he does that. Jazz, as you know, is a more free-flowing type of poetry. And you find much of Langston Hughes's poetry. In other words, he does not write sonnets. He does not write in iambic pentameter. He writes a very free-flowing verse that is sort of a literary version of jazz.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Rob from La Crosse next. Hi, Rob.
Hi. My question is about Du Bois. And he spoke of this metaphor of the mask that black people were forced to wear by white people, and that white people sort of always saw them through this mask. They didn't see them as black people. And it was just like black people sort of had this dual personality they were forced to deal with. So I'd just kind of like to hear your guests talk about that in relation to, you mentioned earlier that Du Bois wanted black people to compose more classical music. I think you said more like white art. And I just wanted to hear you talk about Du Bois' conception of art in relation to that metaphor of the mask. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Thanks, Rob.
Okay, yes, a very good question. Let me rephrase this. I don't want to be misunderstood. Du Bois did not want black writers to write like white artists as much as he wanted African-American writers to write about themes and images that would portray blacks in a very positive manner to whites. And you're right, to whites.
Mm-hmm.
And so that no one could pull out a Claude McKay novel about crime and prostitution and drugs in Harlem and say, well, look, you know, this is what black people are. While, you know, no one worried about pulling up a novel by a white writer that did that because, again, whites weren't being discriminated against. So he had a very strong point here. The Du Bois did use this concept of the mask. And the interesting, you know, the sense, the way he used it is that African Americans sort of shielded themselves; they remained behind the mask, and only at times would they pull the mask aside and reveal themselves. But they would be very reluctant to do that to whites. In a sense, what Langston Hughes is saying is that, you know, we're throwing the mask away. You know, we're writing what we see, Now, there was no consensus among the Harlem Renaissance writers to do this. County Cullen was someone who more or less followed this Du Bois dictum, at least in much of his earlier work. The thing about the Harlem Renaissance is that while it's a literary movement, it's not a movement that is defined by one specific literary style or theme or ideology. It is a group of people each expressing themselves, expressing the African-American experience through their art. And some follow Du Bois' point of view. Many others do not, but the thing about them all is that they're trying to express the African-American experience as they see it.
Our number is 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee. Let's move to a woman for a moment. You write in the book about women not having the easiest of times in the Harlem Renaissance. Zora Neale Hurston, who's really a pretty interesting person here, a highly acclaimed novelist of the Harlem Renaissance, and also such an accomplished anthropologist and folklorist.
Yes, and that's the side of her that's not well known.
Right.
The other part that's certainly not well known is that her novels were really critically attacked by black critics in the 1930s. Of course, now they're recognized as the best. But that's not unusual with artists. They often are not as appreciated in their own time as they will be by the people who come after.
We have a piece here, if you want to set this up for us, Zora Neale Hurston with Mama Don't Want No Peas, No Rice.
Zora had a master's degree in anthropology from Columbia University. Again, these people are well-educated people, even though she really came from a very child and joined the theater group.
My, my.
And ended up getting her undergraduate education at Howard and then came to New York where she studied at Barnard and studied anthropology with the acclaimed anthropologist Franz Boas and published three very significant books on African American and Caribbean folklore. The song that you're talking about was collected when she was on a field trip with the with Smithsonian people and the great folklorist Alan Lomax, and collecting sound recordings. You know, this is very early; it's the 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
Collecting sound recordings in the field. And what she did, she had a very incredible knack of picking up the voice of the people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this is what she does here with this song.
Mama Don't Want No Peas No Rice is a song from Nassau, the Bahama Islands. They're great song makers, and their tunes are decidedly more African than the ones made by the Negroes in America. They make songs so rapidly, they say, anything you do, we put you in sing. And in a few hours, they have a song about it. And Mama Don't Want No Peas No Rice is about a woman that wants to stay drunk all the time, and her husband is really complaining about it. He's explaining to the neighbors what's the matter with his wife and why they don't get along better. Mama don't want no peas, no rice, no coconut oil, no coconut oil. Mama don't want no peas, no rice, no coconut oil, no coconut oil. Mama don't want no peas, no rice, no coconut oil. All she wants is whiskey, brandy all the time.
We're speaking this hour of the program with the editor of Harlem Speaks, A Living History of the Harlem Renaissance, and hearing some of the selections, the poetry, the music that's found. There's a CD in the book as well. And welcoming your phone calls. If you'd like to join us, please feel free to do so to talk about this remarkable time in American history. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, 227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The editor of Harlem Speaks, A Living History of the Harlem Renaissance, is our guest. And the book has many chapters on some of the more famous people from the Harlem Renaissance and also a CD with recordings of their poetry or parts of their books or music from the likes of UB Blake and Duke Ellington, etc. And we're having a really good time here. On a day when we're thinking about sex symbols in 2007. Let me ask you about a sex symbol from the Harlem Renaissance who has such an interesting story, Josephine Baker, who really goes to France, but she's an international sensation, and you call her the first international sex symbol of the 20th century.
Yes. I think of all the people in this book, the one that I find that I'm most intrigued with is Josephine Baker.
Really? Huh.
And it's partly because I had not paid much attention to her before I was working on this book. I don't think I even mentioned her in any of my other work. And she's such a fascinating person. Again, she's one who comes from just the most difficult background, raised in St. Louis in a very, very poor family. Reaches Broadway. She leaves Broadway and goes to Paris. She becomes a star of the Folies Bergère in Paris, where she's noted for her, first of all, her incredible, striking beauty, her, nudity, and our scantily clad performances. And she's just, the rage of all of Europe, performs in the capitals of Europe, in Paris, in Berlin, in the Soviet Union, in Moscow. And is an exotic person. The story,
yes.
The story in her late 20s and early 30s, she has a pet leopard. And she walks down the Champs-Élysées with a leopard on a leash. And, an image that's just, unmistakable. Just incredible. The other thing about her, she achieved her first success. When she was a child, her refuge was the St. Louis Zoo. And she would study the movement of animals, and this is what she brought to dance. So when she was put in a chorus line, she was distinctive.
Huh.
And that is sort of what brought her fame. The other thing, she goes to Paris before she's 20 years of age.
Oh, my.
And within 4 years, she has her own nightclub.
My. Huh. And you talk about the cool reception she received from American critics and also her intolerance of American racism.
Well, she did. On several occasions, she came back for performances and got very lukewarm at best reviews. And she based it, she felt it was on racism. I suspect it was also on a little disdain for someone who left.
Hmm.
You know, left
mm-hmm.
Harlem and went
mm-hmm.
to Paris and came back.
Mm-hmm.
She was, though, very political. And you know, the lesser known things about her that I'm just astonished by is that, you know, most of the a lot of African American creative people went to Europe either for several months or, you know, moved their careers there. But they all came back when the war began, except for Josephine. She remained in France. And she actually worked with the French underground against the Nazis.
Isn't that something? What a life! What a story!
And it's incredible. And received the was highly decorated by the French government at the end of the war.
Oh my gosh.
She was an officer.
Huh.
And then after the war, you know, as she's an aging star, she begins to adopt all of these children. She had no children of her own. She adopts these. A dozen or so children from all over the world, refugees themselves, and calls them her rainbow children.
Huh.
Two of her adopted children have a restaurant on the west side of Manhattan.
No kidding.
Called Josephine.
Oh, my gosh. What a wonderful story. Has anybody done a movie about her?
She's made a couple of movies. No, I don't think there's a movie about her that I'm
Somebody
aware of.
Somebody should. I mean, there's a story you can't pass up.
I think it's an amazing story.
I do, too.
I mean, it truly is.
Yeah. Let's go to Ann from Madison next. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Oh, what a fascinating program. I wondered if Paul Robeson was too late to be considered part of the Harlem Renaissance, and if whether he was or not, if you could talk about his career and especially his political, involvement and interest and so forth.
Paul Robeson, we have a chapter on Paul Robeson. he's he's certainly not too late. He's right in the middle of Harlem Renaissance. He is in New York in the early 1920s when it begins. He's someone else who moves his career to Europe because of racism. For him, and also for Richard Wright, it's in part not wanting their children to experience the type of racism that they experienced.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they don't always escape it in Europe. It's just different. Robeson, again, these are amazing people. Robeson grew up in New Jersey. His mother was killed in a horrible kitchen fire.
Ooh.
When he was just a young child. He was raised by his father, who was a minister, and he was a very good student and a very good athlete, and he got admitted to Rutgers. And although Rutgers did not allow African Americans on their football team, he went out for football, and he was so outstanding the coach took him. He became a two-time All-American and graduated from Rutgers Phi Beta Kappa.
Goodness.
Went to law school and at the same time played professional football. For the sort of the precursor of the National Football League, before they segregated, and got his law degree, but played a couple of seasons of football, but discovered that what he really liked was acting, and he began performing in the theater in New York. He performed in film. His portrayal of the Emperor Jones is just, you know, classic. He also began singing as a concert singer and singing, again, Negro folks, what they called in those days, Negro folk songs and spirituals, and bringing them to the concert, you know, like the Carnegie Hall as an art form.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is doing the same sort of thing Langston Hughes is doing, but doing it in a different way. He lived he was part of the Harlem crowd. He was friends with the Fishers and the Boises and all of these people.
Mm-hmm.
And he became about racial issues and more political. By the time he, or shortly after he got to England, he became very interested in socialism, as did Langston Hughes and Claude McKay and others, and went to the Soviet Union and came back convinced that this was a place where, you know, at least in terms of their theory, race had no place. And was an admirer of the Soviet Union, and this is what got him into trouble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A number of people were called, got into trouble in the 1940s in the McCarthy era.
Mm-hmm. What a story! These people, these lives—you can't believe somebody can do all of this in one lifetime, can you?
These are truly amazing.
Yes, they are
talented, multi-talented
mm-hmm.
people.
Mm-hmm.
Of all the people who faced the McCarthy Red Scare, he was the one who really had his career damaged. Mm-hmm. Langston Hughes sort of bluffed his way through it. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say he perjured himself, but mm-hmm. they didn't know what they were doing with Langston.
Mm-hmm.
And Claude McKay had converted to Catholicism and sort of anti-communism by the 1930s, so he was spared. Richard Wright was in Europe. He didn't come back, so he didn't have the problem. But it really pretty much put a damper on the last years of, Paul Robeson's mm-hmm. career, and he began to suffer ill health. That was probably brought on in part, at least, by the stress of all
mm-hmm.
this.
Yeah. Thanks, Ian, so much for the call. What did in the Renaissance? Was it the Depression? Was it massive numbers of people, too many people coming into a small area and not enough housing, or... You wish it could have flourished for a long period of time. Why didn't it?
Well, it did flourish for pretty much two decades, and for a movement, in an intellectual cultural movement, that's pretty good. It was a lot of things. The economic stress of the Great Depression certainly made it harder to earn a living as an artist, but you had the Federal Writers Program and the Federal Theater
right,
Project,
yes, right.
and that did put some money into it. A number of people were involved in this.
Hmm.
You had the whole question of Harlem and whether Harlem is this metropolis, this African-American metropolis, or a slum. And the truth is it was becoming a slum. And
mm-hmm.
the Harlem riot of 1935 really hit that home.
Yeah. We got to play a little bit of music, which we haven't done. Well, we did, but, I mean, blues or jazz we have to play. Bessie Smith, celebrated as the Empress of the Blues. Do you want to set this up for
us? Oh, well, I'm sorry. I was waiting for the music.
I'm sorry.
Bessie Smith is probably, you know, there's probably three great blues singers, and they're all a little different. Ma Rainey is the predecessor,
mm-hmm.
and she in many ways was Bessie's mentor. Bessie Smith and Ethel Waters. Bessie Smith was just larger than life. She had, she was just an amazing person. Her life was filled with scandal and, generally sexual scandal. And yet her music just overwhelmed people. And then, of course, her life was cut short in a tragic accident when she was, engaged in a comeback, still,
mm-hmm.
quite young. But she was able to take a song, and I think that you'll see that from this recording, and just pour herself into it.
Right. And what a song, Mean Old Bedbug Blues.
That's right.
Here's Bessie. Bessie Smith for you. We're going to go back to phone calls to Mark from Waukesha next. Hello, Mark, you're on the air. Go right ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
I can't remember. I'm embarrassed to admit I can't remember the author of Giovanni's Room. But Langston Hughes and many other people from the Renaissance were reportedly gay and had affairs with people of the same sex, both men and women. And I'm wondering how many of those people who immigrated from America and spent most of their life in, or not most of their life, but moved to Europe, escaped not just racism here, but homophobia and inability to deal with, back then, was just male and male and female-female sexual relations and so on.
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, the truth of it, and this is going to maybe surprise you, it's almost the opposite. The major expatriates, Richard Wright, Josephine Baker, and Paul Robeson, were all, as far as I and any scholar I've read, were solidly heterosexual. You're absolutely right. There was a great deal of bisexuality and homosexuality in the Harlem Renaissance. And yet it doesn't seem that people suffered from it. It was something that was not talked about openly. But it was there, and you can start off with County Cullen was bisexual. Alain Locke, the philosopher and literary critic, was gay and had affairs with a number of the artists of the Harlem Renaissance. Wallace Thurman was bisexual. Langston Hughes is the one that puzzles everybody. One person described Langston Hughes as being non-sexual, as being the person least motivated by sexual passion that they had ever met. He had relationships with women we know of, and he seems to have had relationships with men, although we don't know the extent of that. Langston Hughes was a very private person about his personal life. Claude McKay is a person who bisexual, but probably leaning more towards being gay. It was part of the bohemian creative culture of New York in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. That there is a lot of interaction between Harlem and Greenwich Village, and it is. I mean, the point that you raise is interesting. You would think that this might have been one of the things that pushed people out of New York, but the New York art scene at this time, while it wasn't open and it was sort of more or less behind closed doors, it was quite common. One of the major white figures of the Harlem Renaissance, Carl Van Vechten, who was wrote the novel Nigger Heaven, a very controversial but best-selling novel, he kept an apartment in Harlem, apparently supposedly for his homosexual liaisons. Hmm. There were a number of gay clubs, gay nightclubs in Harlem, ones that catered to some to lesbians, some to gays of whatever gender. It was a sort of the unspoken sort of major sub-theme of the whole Harlem experience at that time.
Mm-hmm. And thanks so much for the call.
Yeah, it's a very, very insightful call.
Yeah. And thank you so much for being... I love these books that have CDs with them, too, with all these precious recordings on them. It's really a lovely way to go through a book. So thank you so much for being with us.
It was truly my pleasure.
Our guest, the editor, I guess you could say, of Harlem Speaks, he's a real scholar of the Harlem Renaissance, a living history of the Harlem Renaissance, Professor Gary Wince, who is a professor of history at Texas Southern University in Houston, the author of Black Culture and the Harlem Renaissance, the Harlem Renaissance Interpretation of an African-American Literary Movement, the Harlem Renaissance, a History and an Anthology, and the list goes on. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Mimi Notstein for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Thanks for listening. The show repeats at 10 o'clock tonight, if you'd like to tell anybody about it. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Have a great weekend. Little Louis Armstrong to take us to the news.
Got to treat me right, 'cause I'm crazy about my loving, and I must have